Boker Tov, everybody. Good morning. It's wonderful to see everybody back together. I'd like to start off today. We have a very special shiur. We have an unusual opportunity of having and hosting Rav Yaakov Nagin. Rav Nagin has been with us 2 years ago, this very same time, as he released his English copy of his Litorei L'Yom Chadash, which was Be Become Blessed, which is his commentary on the parasha. And this time, he is now actually releasing his next English book, which is called The Soul of the Mishnah, Neshama Shel HaMishnah. This is the translation. We have opportunity of hosting Rav Nagin. I'd like to start just by making a special announcement as we remember today our very dear friend and member, Ms. Dr. Mari Cohen, whose Yahrzeit we just passed a few short days ago over Chol HaMoed Sukkos. Moshe Yisrael Menachem Ben David Yehuda HaKohen, Olav HaShalom. Mari used to always come to our shir. In fact, not only did Mari also come to the shir every Sunday morning, he used to be the one to announce the shir every morning with a little sticky note. And he'd usually get upset if the topic had been changed between 12 o'clock at night when he'd written that sticky note the next morning, when perhaps the topic may have changed due to research that went on beyond 12 o'clock at night. We all fondly think of, remember, and continue the legacy of Mari Cohen. And actually, just recently on Simchas Torah, when Jonathan and Alan were doing a special song before the Hakafos, that it was to the Mari Cohen song, and it is very, very special to continue to remember him. He's very much present in all of our lives. We also want to thank and recognize Susan is with us virtually, and it's a pleasure to have you with us and continue to have you with us. We are also going to be thinking this morning of the yahrzeit of Nachum Uri ben Meir Pinchas Yehuda Olav HaShalom. That's Paul Niall Weinberg's son, whose yahrzeit is right now just after Yom Tov as well. It was actually the first year I was in the shul. This is when that terrible tragedy occurred, and we continue in Mitzvah Hashem to gain inspiration, not just from the family, the families that continue, but just the incredible emuna that the Weinberg families continue to have. And Mitzvah Hashem, Nachum Uri should have continued Aliyas Neshama, and his influence should continue for many Doros as we remember him, his name, and his legacy, Be'ezras Hashem. A short time, but a longer legacy. We'd like to just start off by a brief idea of what we're going to be doing today. Is we're learning a little bit about the soul of the Mishnah. I don't want to take away anything that Rav Nagin is going to say, but I do want to make mention of one very interesting perspective, and that is that, technically speaking, we should not have the Mishnah written down. There's a prohibition of writing down any of the oral tradition. The Gemara in Gittin Daf Samach Amud Aleph tells us that when there was on Shabbos afternoons, certain Rabbonim would read from Sifra Da'agarta, they'd read books of teachings, philosophical teachings. And the Gemara says, well, wait a second, you're not allowed to write it down, so how could they be reading it on Shabbos? The Gemara tells us, no, Eis la'asos la'Hashem heferet Torah Secha, quoting a pasuk in Tehillim, Kuf Yud Tes, that at a certain time, it's necessary to undermine, to invalidate part of the Torah in order to preserve it. So it seems that there was going to be a period of shichacha, a period of loss of the ideas of the Torah, and therefore it was written down in order to be able to preserve it. The Maharal asks a very interesting question. If there was a sacrifice made, what was the sacrifice of? At the most, it's that mitzvah, that prohibition of writing down the Torah. Why is it described using the pasuk of Leheferu Torah Secha? Your whole Torah was invalidated by writing it down. You transgressed this mitzvah. Not all the Torah, that doesn't relate to Shemitah, doesn't relate to anything else. So the Maharal explains, that is that sometimes when you write something down, what ends up happening is you allow it to be open to the misinterpretation of others. You allow it to be something which anybody can copy, paste, misinterpret, mistranslate, and misrepresent, which is what we have today, generally speaking. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, if it's preserved in an oral tradition, when you're receiving it orally, with the intonation, with the body language, with the perspective, with the relationship, you're not going to make a mistake. You're not going to make a mistake. And when we wrote it down, that opened the door for misinterpretation, which is Hefer Torah Secha. All of the Torah now became open for this misinterpretation. However, that's the Maharal's answer. However, there is an interesting perspective which is shared by the Shlach HaKadosh. Shlach HaKadosh has a little bit of a different interpretation. He explains why he's going to write a book on the Torah Shebich Seven, the Torah Shebal Peh. And in his introduction, he says the reason why it is called it is Hefer Torah Secha is for the following. Anything which is written down, it's not that it's misinterpreted, but it is reclaimed. Meaning, the Torah Shebichsav, the written Torah, has been reclaimed by other religions. Think about that for a moment, right? Christianity accepts the Old Testament. Islam, although they're not honest about it, built their entire religion of Judaism and the pagan tribes around it. And they, in the Quran, was essentially handpicked psukim in the Torah with a few amendments, you know what I'm saying, and so it's interesting that what was written down became open for abrogation, open for reclaiming by others. The Shlach HaKadosh says the Mishnah itself, the Torah Shebaal Peh, is almost like the simonim that Yaakov gave to Rachel. Why? Because it's all very nice to be able to know who the person is, but you need to have something which is more subtle, something which is, you know, we'll call it above. Just what is written down in order to, at the end of history, be able to come to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and say, we have this for posterity, this is really truly ours, this is our identity. And that was really the Mishnah. Once we wrote it down, essentially, although it was necessary for us, to a certain degree, we were giving away the soul, or part of the simanim, of what really the Torah itself was. It is interesting to note, he makes note in an additional comment. He says, "Va'afilu ata shenitna haTorah shabal peh lichtov." He says, "Natana Kadosh Baruch Hu sina b'leiv ha'umos she'enam chafetzim v'hatakas Torah shabal peh." That the world around us does not like us talking about and printing the Torah shabal peh. Isn't that fascinating? Think about how many times in Jewish history the Torah shabal peh and the printing of the Torah shabal peh has been persecuted. Right, we have a kina on Tisha B'Av particularly about this, but that's not the only time that the books have been burnt and the printing has been stamped out. Even during World War II, the Nazis had a particular vendetta against the Talmud as well. It is interesting to note that this remains to be something which is an innermost understanding or tradition of what it is. So it is with great pleasure that we take a moment to appreciate this, the particular topic, the soul of the Mishnah, in greater context. B'chavod Rav, Harav Nagel.
Well, thank you, Rabbi Trumpf. It's a pleasure to come back to the community here. Lawrence is a community of both very dear friends and also family. Nagen is originally Ginnak, so we have some Ginnaks in Lawrence. And if you recall, there's a way that I begin every shiur. I begin by stating today's Hebrew date, because a remarkable fact about today's date is that it's unique. It never was, and it never will return. Meaning that there's no second chance on today. And realizing that helps push me to make the most out of today. I then asked at a pasuk from Tehillim that talks about simcha, about joy. Because again, we know so much about life is how we approach life. And let's approach it from a good point. So, without further ado, Hayom Chaf Zayin Tishrei. Tav Shin Pei Bet, Zehayom Asa Adonai Nagila V'Nismechavo. And maybe I'll say something about the Rashi Tevot of this year, Tav Shin Pei Bet. In Tav Shin Ayin Vav, which was 2016, was a particularly painful year in Otniel. There were a number of terrorist attacks that year. And at the end of the summer, Avram Fried came to strengthen the spirit of the Toshavim in Otniel. And he said, you know, soon it's going to be a new year. It's going to be Tafshin Ayin Zayin. Do you know what those four letters Tafshin Ayin Zayin stand for? And then he said it stands for Tieshnat Otniel Zoheret Let it be a year of Otniel shining. And the whole year, that blessing carried me along. And indeed, it was a very blessed, beautiful year. But then the sun set. It was no longer Tafshin Ayin Zayin. It was Tafshin Ayin Chet. And he said, what are we going to do this year? So I thought to myself, let it be Tafshin Ayin Chet, Tiesh Nat Otniel Chatunot. And it was a crazy year. We're a small yeshuv, about 170 families, but more than 20 people in the yeshuv got married, including my son to the girl from the same kindergarten. I mean, they've since finished kindergarten, but we still have the pictures of the two of them in kindergarten together. But now we're in Tafshin Pei Bet. And something I heard, which I think is so apropos, the blessing and the challenge of this year, Tafshin Pei Bet, Tiesh Nat Panim B'Panim. Let it be a year of face-to-face. Certainly on the simple level, a year we've been so much isolated from each other on Zoom, a year of face-to-face. And also in a deeper sense, because in Chassidut, in Kabbalah, being panim v'panim, face-to-face, and face means the panim is the inside, is talking about a special and deep connection between people. So let this be Tafshin Pei Bet, Tieshnat, panim v'panim, and we have a whole year to work on it, a whole year to accept this blessing. Now, relating to the Mishnah, the Jewish people are often called people of the book. And as Rav Tam said originally, the book was one book, the Tanakh. For centuries, there wasn't any other book. And suddenly, Rav Yehuda Nasi compiled a work, a masterpiece, which is referred in the Medrash as the iron pillar of the Torah Shebaal Peh. Now, this masterpiece, in some ways, has been overshadowed, of course, by the Gemara. And we've lost something by that, because this work is a masterpiece in its own right. And I believe it's telling us significant messages about Judaism, about life. But since it's often perceived as a means to something else, as a jumping board for the Gemara, as a way to get some basic facts. And also, since the Mishnah is cryptic, it's short, there's so much between the lines that it's not so easy to pick up on. So I feel grateful for the opportunity to help us reclaim the Mishnah as the meaningful masterpiece it really is. And in general, we know that in Israel there have been tremendous creativity in the area of Limud Torah. A lot of it has come to America, in particular relating to Tanakh. And I know that many of my friends, I think Shimon included, sometimes comes to the days that Herzog College has on Tanakh. But somehow, the Torah Shebaal Peh dimension, what's happening in Torah Shebaal Peh in Eretz Yisrael, finding how to make this a work not disjoint from our lives, but something deeply meaningful, that somehow that hasn't made it across the Atlantic. And I hope now that this process is beginning with sharing the translation of Nishmat HaMishnah, the soul of Mishnah, for friends, family, and all of us here in America. I'd like to begin as a preface to the first Mishnah that we'll study together with a story. And unfortunately, as many of my stories, it's a sad story. But again, this Mishnah and its teaching we'll see the redemptive aspect of our Mishnah. In 2008, Israel began the first campaign in response to the missile attacks from Gaza. And the first soldier that fell in that war was called Devir Amanuelov. He was a Talmid in Yeshiva, Avat Yisrael, the love of Israel in Netivot. And one moving story about him is that he was exempt from combat since his father had passed away a year before, but he insisted to be at the forefront of Am Yisrael. He was a commander in Golani. I never met him, but after the war, his mother calls me and tells me there's something I have to know. that after Dvir's father passed away, the Hebrew edition of my book, Nishmat Mishnah, came out, and Dvir decided, in memory of his father, to study Nishmat Mishnah together with his mother. And she said he'd come back from the army, and however exhausted he was, she was, they would always, Le'iloi Nishmat, his father, learn another Mishnah. And then she says, do you know what? The last Mishnah we studied before Dvir fell in combat. And although there's 70 chapters in the book, and they deal with about 200 Mishnayot, somehow I knew what she would tell me. And this is the first Mishnah that we will now study together. And by doing that, you will understand the significance, why it was so significant that this was Dvir's last Mishnah. In Kiddushin, the Mishnah gives us two categories of mitzvot in the context of the family. They're the mitzvot of the av to the ben, and they're the mitzvot haben to the av. First the parent to the child, then the child to the parent. In the printed version of the Mishnah, it begins by av to ben, and then ben to av. But in the Yerushalmi and all the manuscripts, it's first ben, mitzvot ha'av el ha-ben, mitzvot ha-ben el ha'av. Now, why is this significant? When I first read it, I felt somehow a feeling of deja vu. This reminds me of something. And finally, I hit on it. The closing pasuk of Sifrei Nevi'im, the pasuk that tells about the mission of Elio HaNavi, is the pasuk Veheshiv Lev Avot Al Banim V'Lev Banim Al Avotam. And I thought how similar the Mishnah in the Torah Shebal Peh is to that pasuk in the Tanakh. They both talk about relationships of Av to Ben. They're both bilateral, first Av to the Ben and then Ben to the Av. They both use the preposition Al to describe the relationship. The only difference is that the pasuk uses the word lev, heart, whereas the Mishnah uses the word mitzvot. Now, most people, if you asked relationship with your children, the number one thing on the list will it be the heart or the commandments? Probably would go. I would hope go for the heart. We need to connect our hearts together. But nevertheless, I'd like to explain why it's so critical, so significant, the Mishnah taking the heart and making it into mitzvot. There's an essay by Rav Kook called Chacham Adif Minavi. It's based on a statement in the Gemara in Baba Batra, where Rav Kook says the Navi, the prophets, they're filled with inspiration, poets that capture our imaginations. And the Chachamim are often like technocrats that deal with the nitty-gritty little details of life. But then Rav Kook points out that ultimately the Nevi'im failed in their mission during the time of Tanakh to bring Am Yisrael back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and prevent the Churban. Because inspiration is essential, it's great. But what really changes people is commitment to the little details of life. So therefore, the Chachamim succeeded where the Nevi'im failed. We know that the UN has all these beautiful psukim from Yeshayo, but unfortunately there's very little connection to what happens in the UN to those inspirational verses. So we are, of course, not giving up on the heart. But the Torah Shebal Peh tells us how to realize the Torah Shebichtav. If we want the heart of the parents and the children to be together, so the parents need guidance to define them what it is to be a parent, and the children have to know what it is to be a child. And these are what the mitzvot. We have the mitzvot of the Avel Ben, Brit Milah, Pidyon Ben, teaching Torah, finding a profession, finding a spouse, whereas the children, the Talmud defined what it is to be a child, what it is to respect your parents, to honor your parents. It's through defining things, not leaving it fluffy and open, That's how we create the relationship, and in that relationship, we hope ultimately we'll have that heart, we'll have that connection. So, of course, by now you realize how meaningful it was for Dalia that this was the last Mishnah that she and Devir studied before he fell in combat. And I'd like now to make a general statement that the Mishnah very rarely quotes the Tanakh. However, when we remember that the backdrop of the Torah Sheba'al Peh is the Torah Shebichtav, the frame of reference for imagery, ideas, concepts of the Torah Sheba'al Peh is the Tanakh. So we could realize what I see as the reality, that the Tanakh is a major impact. It's behind the surface in endless amounts of places in the Mishnah, even when it's not explicit. And this is what I mean why we need such a close reading of Mishnah. Because if you read it like your newspaper, you're not going to pick up on the deep dialogue that the Mishnah is conducting with the Mikra, with the Tanakh. So in this first example, I will show it's not merely this one point of connection of mitzvot ha'av ala ben, mitzvot ha'ben ala av, to veheshiv lev avot al banim velev banim al avotam. It's more than that. I'll bring one more point of contact. In the book, I talk about the entire chapter, first chapter of Kedushin. But if we continue with the Mishnah, on the page handed out, there's Mishnah Yud. Maybe I'll start with the second half to save some time. It says, the middle of the second line in Mishnah Yud, Kol sheyeshno b'mikra uv'mishnah uv'derech eretz, lo b'mehira hu choteh. If somebody has Torah and has derech eretz, which means a profession, he will not quickly sin. Sheneamar v'chut ha'mushulash lo b'mehira yenatek, v'kol sheyeno lo b'mikra v'lo b'mishnah v'lo b'derech eretz, eino min yishuv. If someone doesn't have Torah and he doesn't have a profession, eino min yishuv. He's not part of the yishuv. Now, it's been pointed out by Rav Avram Wolfish, one of the great pioneers in restoring Mishnah study as a genre in its own right. He points out that these requirements, it really goes back to the mitzvot ha'av al ben, because are you supposed to teach your child? Torah and a profession. Brit Milah, that's a minute. Pidyon HaBen is only for Bechorot. The real day-to-day obligation of what you have should give over Torah, and give over a parnasah, an ability to support yourself, support your family. And thus we have a connection between the Mishnayot. What it would like to add is this also returns us to that prophecy about Eliyahu HaNavi. Because in that closing verse, it begins with Veheshiv lev avot al banim v'lev banim avotam, which I see as the backdrop of the mitzvot ha'av al ben, a mitzvot ha'ben al av. But then it continues, pen avo, lest I come, v'keti et eretz cherem. If this doesn't happen, if we don't have lev avot al banim lev aban al tam, God says that the land will be smitten cherem. The land will be barren. And this is exactly what the Mishnah is saying. The Mishnah is simply continuing the pasuk. If we do not fulfill the mitzvot ha'av al ben, mitzvot ha'ben al av, the result will be eino min yishuv. You're going to be out of the community, out of the society. So it's very significant, this dialogue of the Mishnah and the Mikra. And this, in fact, could help us solve us what I would found as a mystery about the medieval commentaries to this mission of Eliyahu HaNavi. Most of us assume, and I think rightly so, that when that pasuk, Veheshiv lev avot al banim v'lev banu avotam, is talking about what's really at the forefront of our hearts, the relationships between parents and children. But surprisingly, the medieval commentators that I've seen don't explain the verse this way. For example, Tanchum HaYushalmi says, the pasuk is talking about the banim are Am Yisrael and the avot are HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, it's true that sometimes father is an image of God, but we've never found avot in the plural as an image of God. Other commentaries say, heshev lev avot al banim, it's not the father's return connecting to the son, but al is with. The fathers and the sons both are chozer b'tshuva. Now, that's all for that, but it doesn't seem to be the simple meaning of the verse. And the Rishonim even point out, Rashi writes that Chazal understood it. He brings a Mishnah in Ediot that Eliyahu Navi comes to bring peace in the world. Rashi writes that he realizes that Chazal understood the Pasuk as the relationship between the parents and not the parents and children, and not that everybody together is being Chozer B'Tshuva. But this begs the question, so why don't they explain it according to the simple way? Now, the explanation that which is given is that since the topic of that last chapter of Malachi is the Jewish people ask, how can we return to God? So presumably the answer is about returning to God. But nevertheless, Chazal did not understand it that way. I think our Mishnah explains why the way to get back to God is first getting back to one another. The Pasuk says, Zichru Torat Moshe Avdi. Remember the Torah of Moshe. This I'm reading from Malachi Perek Gimel. Zichru Torat Moshe Avdi, Asher Tzeviti Otcha B'chorev. Al Kol Yisrael Chukim Shbatim. You want to get back to the Ribbono Shel Olam? Remember that which was given at Sinai. But wait a second. That happened a long time ago. And it's not necessarily relevant. People might not say, well, it happened far away, a long time ago. Why is this relevant to me? For that part, you're going to need the next pasuk about Hinani sholech lachem et Eliyahu Navi. Lefnei ba yom Hashem agadol vanara, veheshiv lev avot al banim velev banu avotam. If you want to get your children back to Sinai, the way to do it is having the right connection between you. If the parents are parents to their children, if the children know how to be children to their parents, if you have that connection, this is the way that we can make that journey back to Har Sinai and our commitment to that which we received over there. Many years ago, I was at the Marble Arch Synagogue in London, and there was a bar mitzvah, and Rabbi Yonatan Zaks, Zichrono Lebracha, gave the drasha. And this was right before Pesach, so he said, in the ancient world, there were two nations that sought immortality, the Egyptians and the Jews. The Egyptians built magnificent monuments to withstand the winds of time. They built the pyramids, and they succeeded. Everybody in the world heard of the pyramids. The Jewish people had a different way to immortality. We leave Mitzrayim, and the first thing that Moshe says is, "V'igadat levincha," tell it over to your children. The Jewish immortality is the lev avot al banim, lev banim al avotam. And I have a story that maybe captures the contrast between these immortalities. My family lives on the west side of Manhattan, and my wife once took the kids to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which is probably a bad idea because kids and art don't always go together. And they're quite bored, but then they discovered the Egyptian wing, and they really thought that this must be the playground of the museum. And after my son tried climbing on this ancient sphinx, my wife got a lovely escort out of the museum. But when they left, the guard turns to her. Apparently the guard was a very devout Christian and says, "Is that Hebrew your children are speaking?" And he was deeply moved that these very rambunctious children are speaking the same language as the Bible. So in a nutshell, we see the Egyptian immortality behind glass, an immortality of death, and the Jewish immortality of life. And this all goes back to that message, realizing the essence is that mission of Eliyahu HaNavi, who's with us at every Brit Milah, who's with us at the Leila Seder, But as my uncle, Rabbi Menachem Gedak, points out, these are times of the giving over of parents to children. This is the way that we stay faithful to ourselves, faithful to Sinai. Okay? So this is the first teaching I would like to share with you. The last Mishnah of Devir, and the story about making the Mishnah meaningful. The second source we'll deal with. On Shabbat, we began anew reading the Torah Shebichtav. We began anew with Bereshit. So I'd like to begin anew with you the Torah Shebal Peh, which the first Mishnah of the Torah Shebal Peh is the first Mishnah of Brachot. It's a very famous Mishnah, but as a result, and I always find most meaningful to take sources that people already know, and as Marcel Proust has said, the challenge of life, it's not in discovering new lands, but in seeing the old ones with new eyes. So I guess most of us are probably familiar with this first Mishnah in Brachot, but let's take a look at with new eyes and see how meaningful this Mishnah can be. The Mishnah begins, Mematai Koren Shema Barvit, a very natural question, when's the right time to say Shema in the evening? Now, let's imagine we don't know we haven't seen the answer. What we'd imagine the answer to be, when should we say Shema in the evening? And if you had a guess, what would a reasonable answer be? To say Tzeit HaKochavim, some definition of night, whether the stars coming out, maybe the sun going down. So I don't think anybody would have guessed what the Mishnah gave the answer to be. Misha'a shekohanim nichnasim lechol b'truma. At the time that kohanim enter their homes to eat truma. Now, right, this was not an intuitive answer to this question. Now, but this seems to be actually what fundamentally the answer is, because the Tosefta realizes that nobody really knows when kohanim enter to eat truma. So the Tosefta says, Siman ledavar tzeit kochavim. If you want to remember this, because you're not going to remember it, if you want to know when is it that kohanim enter their homes, the siman is tzeit kochavim. But apparently, this really is the reason. Why on earth is Shema Yisrael of the night being determined by when kohanim enter their home to eat truma? Would anyone like to venture a guess or some thought that could guide us? But again, I remember once my students, before they went into the army, Odniel is the Hezri Yeshiva, and I did this mission. I said, guys, you can't go to the army if you don't understand, right now, if you can't understand this first Mishnah, how are you going to go to the army? So I sat with them, and then I decided they were ready after a while, but first I played with them a bit. So I'd like to try to show why this seemingly so puzzling response is really a deep and significant response to the question about why is it that this is the right time to say Shema. Now, one step to solving this mystery, the Gemara, which is on the second half of the page, but maybe I'll say it orally, go back to the oral presentation of the oral Torah. The Gemara says that, in fact, there are a number of other views about when to say Shema in the evening. None of them gave that expected Tzeit HaKochavim Shkiat HaChama. One of them is the time that Aniyim, poor people, come home to eat. Because apparently they would come a little bit earlier because they don't want to waste the sunlight because they can't afford to put a candle on later. Another view is when people come home on the night of Shabbat. And here again, people come earlier home on Shabbat. When they come home to eat on Erev Shabbat. These, they're all different, but there's a common denominator. What's the common denominator between Kohanim nichnasim lechol b'truma, Aniyim nichnasim lechol pito b'melech, and nichlasim, let me get the exact terminology, Erev Shabbos, right? Let's see. Shebnei Adam nichnasim lechol pitam barvei Shabbatot. What's the common denominator between all of these? It's meals. It's the food. Very good. And in addition to the food, coming home for the meal, there's one extra element of that. Maybe you said it. It's what? We should be thankful for everything we get, and maybe that's part of it. But
it's the end of the day.
It's all talking about. It's the end of the day when you come home at the end of the day for the meal. Now, if that's the case, somehow it starts making more sense. So I would like to venture that what's underlying this mission, or maybe even start with one last question and then use it to tie things together. Shema is our great affirmation of Emunah. Now, again, had I not known otherwise, I would say every day we should, again, accept make our statement of Emunah. But twice a day is a little bit less clear to understand why every day. Now, why are we saying Shema twice a day? To keep a long story short, I believe it's connected to the words B'shiftecha bebeitecha uvelechdecha v'derech. Shema Yisrael, we do it. There are two modes of our lives. We have our home life, and we have our life outside the home. And Shema is accepting Malchut Shemayim, accepting a commitment to live according to the will of God in the world. But we have two very different challenges. What it means to be a Jew in your home is not exactly the same thing as being a Jew outside of the home. First of all, some people unfortunately think it's enough to be a Jew in one of those places. In the Haskalah, the Jewish maskilim of the 19th century, one of their mottos, Yehuda Lev Gordon would say, "Be Yudi bo'alecha v'adam metzeitecha." Be a Jew in your home. That's nice, having, you know, it's a personal, private practice, Judaism. That's nice. Do it in your house. But be adam metzeitecha. But just be a regular person on the outside. Don't flaunt your Judaism outside. It could be embarrassing. Be like everybody else. Some people could be the opposite. They could say, let me be a Jew outside, social pressure in some sort of homogeneous community. But at home, I could take everything off. But even more so, even somebody who does want to be a Jew in both places must realize it's two different challenges. Since I teach in yeshiva, I know being a rav in yeshiva and being a husband and father in the house, it's two very different roles, and it's dangerous to confuse them. You don't want your kids to feel that you're Rabbi Trump. I'm sure knows that they have to be that they can't be rabbi. Their kids can't think of you as Rabbi Trump, right? Different challenges, different ways of doing it. So Shema is giving us a tremendously important message. There's Kabbalat Malchut Shemayim at the home, and there's Kabbalat Malchut Shemayim on the outside, at your work and everything else you're doing. That's why twice we say Shema Yisrael. And that's why at the portal that we go from our outside life to our home life is that moment that we enter the house to do our evening meal, that's when we should accept Malchut Shemayim. Okay, so we've gotten to the first part of understanding the Mishnah. But then the second part is understanding the particular choice of the Mishnah among the different possibilities. Who will determine for us the right time, who represents us at the time of entering the home? We could have left it fully open, just simply whenever you get home, say it. But the Mishnah chose to use a particular image to guide us, and that is the image of the Kohen eating Truma. Because the Kohanim, in many ways, are role models, or they symbolically represent something deep about all of us. when we receive the Torah, it says that all of the Jewish people are mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh. We are all holy. We are all kohanim. The eating in the Beit HaMikdash, every day they would bring the korban tamid. And before bringing the korban tamid, they would say Shema Yisrael, to have that korban in the context of accepting Malchut Shamayim. The Kohen eating Truma is another step of expanding the world of the sacred. He eats Truma, and before eating his Truma, he says Shema Yisrael. But the next step gets to us. Many of us are not Kohanim. We're eating donuts or whatnot. But there too, we want to uplift what we do by before coming home, before that meal, saying Shema Yisrael, connecting our consciousness to the divine. And as the Mishnah Pirkei Avot says, if you eat at a table and you've spoken words of Torah, this table is a table in front of the king. So ultimately, the choice the Mishnah took was a choice of Shema begins when we enter our home, when we enter our evening Shema is when we begin our home mode, and we uplift what we do by beginning that with Shema Yisrael. And that's why this particular Mishnah I titled Becoming a Nonstop Jew. And in fact, it's really so, sometimes in Batei Knesset, it has that pasuk, Shaviti Hashem Lenegni Tamid. Let Hashem always be in front of me. Do we have it here? Okay, right over here. But it's great to have it here, but you also have to remember, it has to be on the roads, it has to be in our workplace, it has to be in our homes. And that's the message of Shema Yisrael, whether it's B'shiftecha B'beitecha, whether it's B'lechdecha B'derech, when you get up and you go to sleep, try to all of us to be non-stop Jews. Let me go on to the next Mishnah. So I'll do maybe two more short things to give two a little more taste. The next Mishnah, maybe I'll go oral because to get a little bit more done. I imagine finishing about 9 o'clock is the right time. Okay, is that in the morning, Shema Yisrael, we say till 3. There's one opinion. You have to say Shema Yisrael by Netzach Hama, by sunrise, which would be very challenging for many of us. Fortunately, the halacha is according to Rabbi Yeshua, who says that we get an extra 3 hours. We could say Shema Yisrael until 3 hours into the day. Now, why? Because she came derech b'nei melachim, lamod b'shiloshot. Because the children of kings get up 3 hours after sunrise. Now, Rav Yosef Karo in the Kesef Mishnah asks, he said, wait a second. This is a statistically insignificant group. Why are we determining uf komecha, the time of getting up, based on this statistically insignificant group? And this ultimately leads him to decide that the times must only be drabanan because he doesn't see this as something that could really define the time of waking up. I would like to venture a suggestion that this is that Rabbi Yeshua is connecting to a very fundamental statement about who we are. In a number of places in the Mishnah, it says that all of the Jewish people are B'nai Malachim Heim. And Rabbi Akiva in Pirkei Avos says that indeed, Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tselem, Judaism sees all humanity as holy, all created B'Tselem Elohim, but Am Yisrael are a privilege for a special relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam, Chaviv Yisrael Shnikru Banim Lamakom, the children of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And there's a story that Rav Bezinson, a Breslev Chassid, tells about a boy standing on the seashore waving to this enormous ship at sea. And somebody passes by and says, who are you waving to? He says, I'm waving to the captain of the ship. And the person says, why on earth do you think the captain of this big ship is looking at this little kid? And the child says, I know he's looking at me because the captain of the ship, he is my father. So we accept, as Am Yisrael, we accept Malchut Shemayim. We accept HaKadosh Baruch Hu as our king, but the king is our father. Okay, so we'll do one more Mishnah, and we're blessed to have more and more. And whenever I come to America, I see how much one of the blessings of our generation, I think, is that the Torah is now, as it should be, Torah and Tefillah of the men and the women together. And something I know people, the old people realize that this is a phenomena which is a blessing which is growing from year to year. My wife is the head of a women's institution post-high school with 100 students a year. And part of this blessing, I'd like to go back to a Mishnah that talks about the Avodat Hashem of women. It's well known throughout Israeli society that Tu B'Av, the 15th day of Av, they call it Chagava. It's become, which I think, a sort of Israeli Valentine Day. Now, it's that because somehow people have heard that there was this dance of women on Tu B'Av. And part of it was engaging their future spouses. What people less notice is that dance takes place twice a year. It takes place on Tu B'Av, and for reasons I explain in my book. But what I also point out, that the primary day of the dance of Benot Yerushalayim, why this is the primary day, again, this is something beyond the time we have today, the main day of the dance of the woman was on Yom HaKippurim. And not only that, what makes Yom Kippur, what captures the special aspect of Yom Kippur, is this dance. Because the Mishnah, we have it here in Tanit, says the Mishnah Chet, Amar Rabban Shimon Gamliel, Lo yayamim tovim liYisrael k'chamisha asar ba'av u'kiyom akipurim shebehem banot Yerushalayim yotzot v'kli lavan shulim shelo levayis et mi she'ein lo kol akilim tunim tefila. On Tu B'Av and on Yom Kippurim, which again, Yom Kippurim is called, there weren't better days for Am Yisrael than Yom Kippur. Why? They don't mention the Tshuva. They don't mention the Kohen Gadol. What makes Yom Kippur, what captures the spirit of Yom Kippur, is the Benot Yerushalayim dancing in the vineyards. And so I'd like to explain, why is it that this dance is so essential? Why did this capture the essence of what Yom Kippur is, such a sacred day? And yet, the Mishnah gives us a few ingredients. The woman would wear white clothing. And very nicely said, they would all borrow from each other, so that we shouldn't have social pressure who has the nicest dress. So you wouldn't wear your own dress, you would give it to somebody else. And then the Mishnah, in addition to wearing white dresses, they also would, it says that the kol hakelim tum tefila, they would have to take all the dresses and be tovel them in a mikvah before this dance. Okay, so with these ingredients, can this help somebody along to begin getting an inkling about what this sacred dance is about?
Similar to the Kohen Gadol.
Exactly. The Kohen Gadol enters Kodesh HaKadoshim on Yom Kippur. He is wearing white clothing. He goes through Tefillah B'Mikvah. And also, the Mishnah in Chagiga says in general, all Kelim is also clothing, before the Chag, Kol HaKelim Tunim Tefillah. The same words here are said about before every Chag. This is true about everything used in the Beit HaMikdash. We are saying that this dance of the woman is paralleling the entrance of the Kohen Gadol to Kodesh HaKadoshim. They're wearing the white clothing, they're having the tefillah. But why is it? Why is this dance that parallel? And why is it so important? So for this, I'll have to read a little bit more in the Mishnah. Again, to save time, first they turn to the men. Benot Yerushalayim yotzot v'cholot b'kamim. The daughters of Yerushalayim would dance in the vineyards. Mein amrot b'chor sanei necharei ma tabarlacha. Al titein enecha benoi, tein enecha b'mishpacha. Sheker achein ve'vayofi isha yirat Hashem itel. They turn to the to the men, the single men. And later, I skip a bit. V'cheinu omer, they quote Shir Shirim. Tzenerena benot Tzion, b'melech Shlomo. Batarash etrelo imo, b'yom chatunato, u'b'yom simchat libo. B'yom chatunato zumatan Torah, u'b'yom simchat libo zebinyan Beit HaMikdash. They bring a verse from Shir HaShirim talking about marriage, but that verse about marriage in the love story of Shir HaShirim, they use it in relation to the Beit HaMikdash and the giving of the Torah. Now we know that, and I think now we have all the pieces to understand why this dance captures the essence of Yom Kippur. Shir HaShirim, Rabbi Kiva says, is Kodesh Kodashim. And using that word, he says, Kol HaKtuvim Kodesh, the entire Tanakh is holy. But Shir HaShirim is Kodesh Kodashim. He's using an imagery of the Mikdash. The Mikdash is holy, but the Holy of the Holiest is Kodesh Kodashim. Now there's one day a year that the Kohen Gadol enters Kodesh Kodashim. And in that entry, the Gemara tells us that the two Kruvim on the Brit, one was like an Ish, one was like an Isha, to see that the great intimacy of the Jewish people and the Kadosh Baruch Hu on Yom Kippur is like the great intimacy between Ish and Isha. And that's why Shir HaShirim is. That's why Shir HaShirim is Kodesh Kodashim. Because Shir HaShirim, which is an allegory about the relationship and the love between the Jewish people and Am Yisrael, and in that love story, the Jewish people are depicted as the woman. And in particular, the women that appear often in Shir HaShirim are Benot Yerushalayim. And that's what's happening in our Mishnah. The Benot Yerushalayim, the heroes of Shir HaShirim, they are dressing in white, like a bride, like the Kohen Gadol, with a process of Tvilah, of Tahara. And this dance, just like Shir HaShirim as literature, depicts this love story, on Yom Kippur, this dance of the woman actualizes Shir HaShirim as a sacred dance. The woman represent the entirety of Am Yisrael, the Jewish people, in a love dance in front of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, which captures the Kodesh Kodashim of this great intimacy of connection of Yom HaKippurim. And in fact, this Mishnah is in Tanit. Why Tanit? Tanit is the day of fasting. Because the previous Mishnah talks about the tragedies of the Jewish people, the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, and earlier, the breaking of the first Luchot on Shivat Tammuz. And here we have the Tikkun. We had the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, and now we have, the Mishnah ends, brings Shir HaShirim, says Shir HaShirim, this marriage is talking about the Beit HaMikdash, that arena of deep connection. And here, in the context of the Mikdash of Yom Kippur, the day that we purify the Mikdash, we have this sacred dance of fulfilling Shir HaShirim as a tikkun of the destruction. And on Shivat Shabbat Tammuz, it says that Moshe went down. Exactly. He has the luchot. He sees dancing for Avodah Zarah. And the luchot are smashed and break. And here, Yom HaKippurim is the day that Moshe received the second luchot. Yom Kippur is the tikkun of the breaking of the luchot. So here too, there is a dance, but not a dance for Avodah Zarah, but a dance in front of Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And a dance by the woman, because there are sources that the women were not part of the Chet Egel. And in the context of the dance, there is another tikkun. In the Chet Egel, it says that the people began litzachek. Litzachek is a euphemism for Giloy Arayot. And here in the context of the dance, in purity, the single woman make contact with single woman men to try to build their homes together. So this dance is the great crisis is, the breaking of the Luchot, the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, brings us to the pinnacle, Yom Kippurim, of the great intimacy of Am Yisrael and Kadosh Baruch Hu, and those who represent us and those who lead us are the women. So these are some of the Torah thoughts in that I'm grateful to share with you today in Nishmat HaMishnah, which I'm so grateful now is in the soul of Mishnah. And I particularly would like to thank my very dear friends, Shimon and Rachel Laufer, who helped sponsor making this possible for this translation to take place. If you recall, I think part of life is balancing things. I think a lot of the messages we've had today were about balancing different aspects of life. And therefore, since we began with Simcha, part of Simcha is great, but even Simcha must have a fuller context. So just like on Chag HaSukkot, Isman Simchatenu, but we read Kohelet, so too, if I began with Simcha, let me end with the Pasuk in Kohelet, Sof Davar, Hakol Nishma, Et HaElohim Yira, Ve'et mitzvotav shmor kizeh kol hadam. And hello also to all the people that are together with Zoom. And nishma, we know is otiot nishma. So this should be a iloy nishma for the very special people that Rabbi Trump mentioned at the beginning of our share today.
You guys might have a headache.